The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable, settle in, turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 14, Episode 22. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing three tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Finn McCool, Nikki Exposito, and Dale Thompson. Tonight we'll hear stories of menacing matrons, awful aristocrats, and cracked cultists. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first two spine-tingling stories. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So, lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show's about to begin. Neighborhoods. Communities. On the one hand, they seem so quiet, so unassuming, and most of the time, people just go about their daily lives. But sometimes there's that one house on the block nobody wants to walk past, or where people go in and never come out, or even that weird community center group that always meets well after dark and the lights in the building keep flickering. Yes, sometimes it's not the unknown you should be worried about. It's the people you know all too well. Finn McCool brings us the first tale of the night with a dip into suburbia and what is normally a helpful thing, the Neighborhood Watch. The watch is there to keep everyone safe, right? Make sure nobody comes around smashing in windows and whatnot. What about that old saying, though? Who watches the watchman? Without further ado, I present to you Mrs. Jones' Neighborhood Watch. It was never my intention to get on the wrong side of Mrs. Jones from number 5. Sure, I never liked the woman. I always considered her a busybody, a village tyrant who thought she ruled over the whole neighborhood. Widow Jones had long been the head of our local homeowners association and seemed to take a perverse pleasure from imposing meaningless rules and regulations, and she generally liked to stick her nose into other people's business. Her bully-like behavior didn't sit right with me, but I'm not someone who likes confrontation, so I prefer to keep my head down and not cause problems. If I'm honest, I'd have to say I gave in way too easily to Widow Jones's petty demands, and I submitted without argument when she ordered me to move my garbage cans or mow my slightly overgrown lawn. Likewise, I would turn a blind eye whenever the woman harassed and bullied my neighbors, berating them in the middle of the street for everybody to see. I'd peek through my curtains to observe these arguments, and my blood would boil when I saw the white-haired Mrs. Jones humiliating those poor people. But I would never intervene. I told myself it wasn't my fight, and so would retreat into the warmth and safety of my comfortable suburban home, soon forgetting all about the unpleasantness. I suppose I could have continued to live like this indefinitely, but in time, the situation on my home street escalated, and Mrs. Jones transformed from a petty old woman with too much time in her hands to a dangerous tyrant with a frightening level of control over her followers. It all started last month when our normally quiet and peaceful neighborhood was subjected to several acts of minor vandalism. I'm talking about eggs thrown at windows, toilet paper left hanging from tree branches, small-scale teenage pranks that you'd expect to see from time to time. But of course, Widow Jones and her people blew the whole thing out of proportion, acting like our community was in the midst of a deadly crime wave. Before long, we were all dragged into an emergency HOA meeting, during which Mrs. Jones spoke at length about the great threat facing our community and how we had to take decisive action to protect ourselves. Her solution was a neighborhood watch scheme, a group which would, of course, be led by Mrs. Jones herself and packed with her closest supporters. This faction included the Smiths, a childless couple with multiple cats who roamed the neighborhood and had an unpleasant tendency to leave little presents on my lawn. Then there was the Colonel, an ex-military man who retained his no-nonsense persona and passion for strict discipline. The Colonel also kept a substantial collection of firearms and bladed weapons, and he was said to be very proficient in hand-to-hand combat. Finally, there was Harriet, a middle-aged spinster known for her bizarre behavior and nasty habit of spreading gossip and false rumors among the other neighbors. I could just about deal with these odd characters on a one-to-one basis, but together, under the direction of Mrs. Jones, this group were an unholy terror. I did my best to avoid their suburban vigilante gang, although I would often observe their activities from my bedroom window, watching as they patrolled our tidy street of detached two-story houses, neat green lawns, and white picket fences. And all the time, they were searching for violent criminals who simply did not exist in this place. There was something particularly sinister about this little group who'd let the little power they had go to their heads. Soon they began acting like Stasi, constantly patrolling the block and aggressively challenging anyone unfamiliar or vaguely suspicious. They always had their phones out, messaging each other in their private group and videoing constantly, violating people's privacy, whilst arguing that such measures were necessary for the protection of the community. Like I said, I wasn't keen to get involved, even though I didn't agree with what these people were doing or the way they conducted themselves. But this all changed one night when I witnessed a violent altercation that I couldn't ignore. I was watching television in my front room with the curtains drawn when suddenly I heard a commotion from outside, as raised voices and the sounds of a scuffle caused me concern. The hairs on the back of my neck stood on end as I slowly made my way to the window and discreetly peeked out through the curtains. I saw a disturbing scene unfolding on the road and illuminated by the streetlights. The vigilante patrol was there, of course. Widow Jones wasn't present as far as I could see, but the rest of the gang were there, and no doubt following their leader's orders. My four neighbors had formed a tight circle surrounding a teenage boy who had, unfortunately, fallen afoul of their patrol. The kid had dark hair and a thin stubble on his chin, which I guessed was his adolescent attempt to grow a beard. He wore a tracksuit and a baseball cap, and he was giving attitude to the watch members, talking back and trying to look tough. However, I could just about see the frightened expression on his face under the dim light. Clearly, the kid was scared. I was uncomfortable at witnessing this scene, and unfortunately, it soon escalated. I guess the teenager must have made an insulting comment toward Mrs. Smith, because her husband stepped forward to defend his wife's honor. Mr. Smith was a big guy, and he didn't hold back, punching the kid so hard in the stomach that he keeled over in pain. This was too much for me. All of a sudden, I experienced a surge of adrenaline which prompted me into action. Before I knew it, I was charging out into the street, ready to confront the aggressors for the first time. However, I think my courage started to waver once I was halfway across the asphalt, because when I shouted at the mob, my voice was already breaking. "Hey there! You can't do that! Leave the kid alone!" In an instant, all four turned in my direction, all casting me furious glares. I think they were surprised that I challenged them, and there was a pause before anyone spoke. In the end, it was the colonel who piped up, speaking to me in a tone which was both authoritative and condescending at the same time. "This is none of your concern, young man. You should return to your home without delay." As it happened, the colonel wasn't much older than I was, but I knew they all looked down their noses at me. I was invisible to them, a quiet and passive neighbor who they could boss around when they wanted to, but otherwise ignored. But I'd had enough of this shoddy treatment. Wouldn't turn a blind eye to this. But before I could reply, the teenager pulled himself up off the ground and cried out to me with terror in his voice. "Hey man, you gotta help me. These guys are crazy." Mr. Smith responded by giving the kid a hard slap across the back of his head. The teenager yelped in pain and shock. He tried to run, but Mr. Smith and the colonel grabbed him, holding him firmly as he struggled in vain. "Hey, you can't do that," I shouted. "Yes, we can," the colonel replied confidently. "This little hoodlum is the one who's been egging our houses and cars. We're effecting a citizen's arrest, as is our right under law." "Oh, come on," I shot back. "He's just a kid who played a few stupid pranks. Hardly a criminal mastermind." The kid continued to struggle as the colonel opened his mouth to reply. I could tell from his facial expression that the military man was fast losing his patience with me. Meanwhile, Mrs. Smith and Harriet had remained strangely silent during the exchange, but I now noticed how they both had their phones out and were recording. They weren't videoing the incident with the teenager. Instead, they were filming me, cruel smirks on their lips as they sought to intimidate me. "Have you ever heard of the broken windows theory?" the colonel eventually asked. "Today it's vandalism, tomorrow it'll be break-ins, and the day after that, we'll be dealing with violent muggings. It's a slippery slope. We must act now to avoid anarchy further down the line. I could hardly believe the twisted logic of this argument, and couldn't think of what to do next. But later, a moment later, a car pulled up in front of me, a black sedan which I recognized right away. It was Mrs. Jones' car, and the woman herself was in the driving seat. She lowered her window and stared out at me with her piercing green eyes. In an instant, I felt like a guilty child as all my former confidence melted away. Mrs. Jones wasn't so much angry as she was surprised by my presence, and she asked, "What are you doing here?" I opened my mouth to respond, but I discovered I couldn't find the words. I don't know why, but the woman had that effect on me, and I wasn't able to stand up to her at that moment. Instead, it was left to the colonel to explain the situation from his perspective. "This gentleman's causing trouble," he said. "He doesn't like the way we do things." "Well, isn't that a shame?" Widow Jones replied in a very patronizing tone. Of course, our neighbor hadn't bothered to ask. He'd know we're bringing this individual to the police so he can be dealt with appropriately. Everything we're doing is perfectly legal and above board. With that, Mrs. Smith and Harriet opened the car doors whilst continuing to film me, while the colonel and Mr. Smith forced the boy into the back seat. I saw the pure terror in the kid's eyes as he fought against the two grown men holding him and cried out in protest. "No! Let go of me, you assholes! You can't do this to me!" Deep down, I knew they weren't taking the kid to the cops. I knew, but still, I did nothing. Instead, I looked on helplessly as the entire group piled inside Mrs. Jones' car and drove off. The kid turned his head and looked out at me through the rear windscreen, his eyes pleading for help, which I had failed to provide. I experienced an intense guilt as I stood on the curb, watching as the car reached the end of the street and turned, soon disappearing from sight.
You can live out your MasterChef dreams when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
I returned to my home soon after the incident, but I couldn't rest, as the stress of what I'd just witnessed kept me awake. I decided to do the responsible thing and call the cops to explain what had happened. An officer took down my report and said he'd look into it. I guess I should have realized that they were fobbing me off, but I did feel slightly better after I hung up the phone. I'd done my civic duty, and surely the police would ensure the kid was dealt with fairly. With this task completed, I was finally able to sleep. But little did I know that this was only the beginning of my nightmare. I went to work the next day as normal and gradually forgot about the ugly incident the night before. It was only once I arrived home that I received an unpleasant reminder. I drove up to my house and parked in my driveway, only to find an unwelcome visitor brazenly sitting on my front porch waiting for me. It was Mrs. Jones, wearing a long black dress and matching shroud like she often did, her white hair in curls, and her piercing eyes staring directly at me. She was sat upon a wooden bench in front of my home like she owned the place and I was the intruder. I sighed deeply as I exited my car and walked over to the woman, dreading the difficult conversation that was surely coming. Widow Jones smiled when she saw me, a false grin, etched across her wrinkled face, which I could tell was completely put on. "Good evening, sir," she said while standing up to meet me. "Hi, Mrs. Jones," I said sheepishly. "What can I do for you?" I noted how she was blocking my route to my own front door, and yet I couldn't summon the courage to push past her. It's amazing how this elderly woman of small physical stature could have such power over me. "Well, neighbor, I just thought we should catch up after the incident last night. Make sure there were no misunderstandings." "I see," I said, whilst looking over my shoulder and scanning the street. I couldn't shake the unpleasant feeling that I was being watched. "I understand you contacted the sheriff's department," she continued. I felt a cold chill run up my spine upon hearing those words. How did she know I'd called the cops? "I can see your surprise," Mrs. Jones said. "Well, you should know that I'm an old friend of the sheriff and his wife, and we work closely with the local police." "What'd you do with the kid?" I interjected, suddenly finding my voice. Widow Jones looked angry at the interruption, but retained her cool composure and answered me. "We did nothing to them. The police released the young man with a warning, but I understand he's currently missing. The poor kid is clearly very disturbed. I hope he can find peace." "That's a load of BS," I exclaimed angrily. "You hurt that kid. I know you did." The woman glared at me, her eyes practically cutting through me. I couldn't meet her gaze, and in that moment, I feared I'd gone too far. And then Widow Jones started walking down the steps, slowly and purposely. Soon she was right up beside me, placing her cold hand on my shoulder and whispering in my ear. I was paralyzed by fear, unable to move or resist her poisonous words. "Turn around," she ordered. "There's something I want to show you." I did as instructed, as if I was now under her spell. She pointed to the house directly across the street. "Now what do you see?" she asked cryptically. "It's Mr. Anderson's place," I replied nervously. "Indeed," the widow confirmed. "You see the garish color he's painted his fence, the long grass and untidy hedges, those damn pigeons he keeps in his backyard that crap all over the street? He makes noise and upsets all of our neighbors. I've spoken to him many times, but he never listens. Alas, I don't think Mr. Anderson's going to last much longer on our street. He really isn't our type of people." She paused briefly, looking directly at me with those damned bewitching eyes. "What about you, young man? Are you a good neighbor or a bad one?" She didn't wait for an answer before continuing. "I used to think you were one of the good guys. You never complained or made a fuss. I always did as you were told. But then you started harassing my people, going to the cops, making wild accusations. If I were you, I'd be careful, very careful indeed." I snorted in an attempt to sound dismissive, but in truth I was frightened, and I think she knew it. Satisfied that her message was delivered, Widow Jones calmly walked down my driveway, casting me a parting glare and a cruel smirk as she crossed the street. And I just stood there and didn't say a word. I didn't sleep at all that night and wasn't able to focus the next day at work. I just couldn't forget the widow's chilling words and her implied threat. What had she done to the missing kid? And what would she do to me if I stepped out of line? I didn't go straight home after work. Instead, I left my car at the office and went to a local bar to drown my sorrows. I got a cab home later that night, feeling worse for wear after drinking heavily. My recollection is somewhat hazy at this point in the evening, but I do recall the taxicab pulling up onto our street and parking opposite my house. I paid the driver and shakingly exited my cab. But then I rubbed my eyes, and guess who was standing on the curb watching me? It was Widow Jones and her people. The five members of that damned community watch, all of them glaring at me with disapproval and contempt in their eyes as I drunkenly made my way across the otherwise quiet street. I couldn't stand their scornful looks, and I guess the alcohol granted me renewed courage because I shouted across at the group with defiant anger, crying, "You can all go to hell, you damn psychopaths!" The colonel, the The Smiths and Harriet continued to glare at me with pure hatred in their dark eyes, but they didn't act or utter a word. Mrs. Jones's reaction to my outburst was rather different, however. She simply smiled at me, shooting a wide but very disturbing grin while she raised her hand and wagged her finger at me, telling me off like I was a disobedient puppy who'd peed on the carpet. However, I wasn't in the mood to back down on this occasion, so I defiantly gave her the middle finger before shouting, "Screw you too, you old witch!" I expected an angry rebuke, but the widow's smile did not falter. Suddenly, I felt extremely uneasy as I stumbled along my driveway and up my front steps, fumbling for my keys before I retreated inside the house and slammed the door shut behind me. I didn't have any trouble falling asleep. Thanks to my alcohol intake, I pretty much collapsed on my bed and passed out. But my slumber was far from restful, my dreams plagued by images of Widow Jones as she haunted my subconscious. In one nightmare, I charged across the street to attack her, only to find my punches were weak and useless. She brushed me off with the mere flick of her hand, laughing cruelly as I fell heavily to the curb and couldn't get back up. And when she looked down upon me with her predatory eyes, I knew I was entirely at her mercy. I guess I must have been out for a couple hours before I was rudely awakened by a loud banging noise. I shot up from my pillow in a panic, soon realizing that somebody was trying to smash my front door down. No prizes for guessing who it was. Suddenly, I felt quite sober as I jumped up from my bed and went to the window, looking down to see the community watch members standing on my porch. All wore black clothes and hoods, but were clearly recognizable. And to my horror, I saw all four were armed. The colonel carried a sawed-off shotgun while the two women wielded sharp daggers, and Mr. Smith was swinging a sledgehammer, smashing it against my front door in a determined effort to break in. My heart beat fast in my chest, and I struggled to breathe. Meanwhile, my panicked brain desperately tried to come up with a plan. I grabbed hold of my phone and started to dial 911, but then I remembered what Widow Jones had told me the day before. She was friends with the sheriff, so would the cops even come? I was still considering this when my phone started to ring. I looked at the screen and I saw I had an incoming call from an unknown number. I swiped with a shaking hand, pressing the phone to my ear as I spoke through trembling lips. "Hello?" I said as the banging on my door continued. "I did warn you," said the voice on the other end. It was the voice I recognized right away, that of Widow Jones. "You won't get away with this," I spat back. "You and your attack dogs are going to get caught." Widow Jones laughed in open mockery. "Oh, I don't know, so. The police are no danger to us, and none of the residents will say a word. As for you, well, you're all alone. You don't have close family or friends. Who's going to notice if you disappear? Who will even care?" I felt a lump in my throat and tears welling up in my eyes. Meanwhile, the banging grew louder, and I knew my door wouldn't hold for much longer. I didn't know what to say, but Mrs. Jones wasn't done. "I'm a fair woman, so I'm giving you one last chance. My people have got a taste for killing after they dispatched the teenage hoodlum. I know how to control them, but the gang have a lust for blood tonight. Somebody's going to die. That's inevitable. It's either going to be you or somebody more deserving." Suddenly, the door smashed open, and I heard heavy boots stomping on my hardwood floor. I continued to cower in my bedroom, knowing I had no means to defend myself. But I continued to clutch a tight hold of my phone, realizing Mrs. Jones offered my only lifeline. "Time for a decision," she said ominously. "I need to say you'll be a good neighbor and do what you're told. I demand total obedience." I heard them storming up the staircase and knew that I'd run out of time. I almost choked out the words, but somehow I managed to reply, and what I said would haunt me to the end of my days. "I'll do it. I'll do whatever you want," I whimpered. "Good boy," she replied smugly, before abruptly ending the call. By now, the mob had reached my bedroom, and all four stood in the doorway with manic looks in their murderous eyes, and their weapons at the ready. I backed off and held up my hands defensively. I'd done what their leader wanted, but feared it was already too late. Then, a moment later, I heard a cacophony of ringing phones and watched as all four of my assailants reached into their pockets and withdrew their devices. I stood frozen as I observed their gang quietly reading the message they'd all received, and suddenly the murderous tension in the room faded, and the four lowered their weapons and reluctantly moved away from the doorway, making their way back down the stairs. The colonel was the last to leave, shooting me a killer's glare before he moved away. My heart was still beating fast as I ran back to my bedroom, in time to see the vigilantes exiting my home and quickly making their way across the street to Mr. Anderson's house. And I knew the mob had a new target. I experienced a renewed terror, watching helplessly as Mr. Smith went to work on my neighbor's door, smashing it hard several times with his hammer before he broke through. Next, all four piled inside of Mr. Anderson's home, screaming blue murder as they continued their rampage. I heard a violent scuffle inside the house, closely followed by a gunshot. Mr. Anderson's pigeons reacted to the loud noise by flying upwards into the night sky. Then there was a brief pause before poor Mr. Anderson stumbled out of his front door and onto the street. He was only in his underwear, in a hole in his stomach, wheezing in agony as his blood poured from the freshly made bullet wound. For a moment I thought he might make it to safety, but the vigilantes soon followed him outside. The colonel stood back, still smoking gun in his hands, as he observed his bloody handiwork. The two women, Mrs. Smith and Harriet, ran forward, knocking Mr. Anderson down before setting upon him with their knives, stabbing him repeatedly while he lay helpless on the asphalt. Mr. Anderson screamed, and I felt sick to my stomach at witnessing such savage violence. The women must have stabbed him more than a dozen times in the chest before they finally stopped, their clothes and faces now covered in dark blood. Amazingly, Mr. Anderson was still breathing, but this state of affairs didn't last for long. As the women stepped back, Mr. Smith stepped forward, using immense strength to wield his hammer, bringing it down upon Mr. Anderson's head and crushing his skull like it was a watermelon. I couldn't stand the bloody viscera, recoiling and retreating from the window and retching in disgust. And the worst thing was knowing I was at least partly responsible. Mr. Anderson had died because I'd given in to the tyrant. He'd died so I could live. By dawn, the murder scene had been cleaned up. Mr. Anderson's body was removed and presumably disposed of, and the blood and gore were carefully washed off the road. It was like nothing had ever happened. The police weren't called, and no one living in the neighborhood said a word. To this day, I don't know why Widow Jones turned from being a neighborhood busybody to a cold-blooded killer. Perhaps something inside of her snapped, or maybe she was always this way, deep down. Nor do I understand the hold she has over the members of her murderous neighborhood watch. Is she a witch with supernatural powers, or simply a human monster with a cult-like following possessing psychotic tendencies? I don't have the answers, and I now realize that this situation is beyond me. I see the way she looks at me, and I know it's only a matter of time before she sends her attack dogs to finish what they started. Call me a coward, if you will, but I don't want to die here. My bags are packed, and I'm leaving tonight. I can only pray that I never see Mrs. Jones or any of her vicious cult again for as long as I live. I hope you enjoyed Mrs. Jones' Neighborhood Watch by Finn McCool, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Finn-McCool. That's simplyscarypodcast.com finn-mccool. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Have a question. How would the neighborhood watch feel about a for sale sign? Something tells me that a lot of houses there would have a lot of signs, but also say that the previous owner vanished under mysterious circumstances. But despite the best efforts, no community is immune from trouble. Why, even the very elites with their country clubs and whatnot can still run into the most difficult of families and their members. Take, for instance, this little tale from Nikki Exposito about a particular family that seems to cause trouble of the most outrageous kind in a high-class atmosphere. Without further ado, I present to you, no longer welcome at the Six Seahorse Sands Club. Sirs and madams, this correspondence will serve as official notice. The Whittington Stanley family is hereby banned from the Six Seahorse Sands Country Club. Dr. Mortimer Whittington Stanley, Mrs. Cornelia Whittington Stanley, their sons Roderick Whittington Stanley and Elliot Whittington Stanley, as well as any and all relations and associates, are forbidden from club grounds. Club management and staff have extended to this family the utmost patience and grace. We've explained the rules and the consequences of breaking said rules many times, many ways, in the plainest of English. Yet still, the disreputable clan has it set in their heads that the rules don't apply to them, a delusion from which they're incapable of being weaned. Enough is enough. To avoid conversational unpleasantness and to shield the Six Seahorse Sand staff from an unabating deluge of repetitive and benign questions, I will catalog here the series of misadventures culminating in the Whittington Stanley's banishment. 1. The Van Beek Wallace Wedding. Let's not mince words. Wilbur Van Beek was an unpleasant man. In fact, to be completely frank, I found Mr. Van Beek the most distasteful embodiment of simultaneous opulence and cheapness. I will freely admit I've spent many a night reorganizing the cutlery closet simply to avoid his diatribes about estate tax law. But, lest we forget, we all accepted Mr. Van Beek's stock tips without complaint, and were happy to indulge in the fine French champagne he brought home from Paris Fashion Week, as well as the attentions of the leggy French beauties whose passage to America and enrollment at the finest modeling academies in the city Mr. Van Beek kindly funded. And during our unfortunate financial bottleneck last spring, Mr. Van Beek offered the club an extremely generous loan to repave the tennis courts. Because of this generosity, many of you were obliged to cheerfully attend the wedding of Mr. Van Beek's daughter, Madeline, to Mr. Ashton Plank Wallace III. Again, I will not mince words. The event was a grotesque carnival of plutocracy, offensive to club management and our valued members not possessing the financial largesse required to, say, hire an African lion and giraffe calf from the elite rental company, displayed in cages during cocktail hour. The caviar station was wholly unnecessary, as were the imported Spanish red jumbo prawns, the prime cuts of steak butchered on Mr. Van Beek's Texas ranch, and the exotic sushi prepared by master chefs flown in from Tokyo. The wedding cake would have been perfectly sumptuous without a coating of gold leaf, and 18 tiers were at least 5 too many. I'm sure Miss Van Beek's dress could have arrived through channels besides a private plane from Milan, and a man whose wealth commands imported prawns and private planes could definitely have insisted less forcefully upon a no-tip policy for the servers and bartenders. But I digress. The point is, it was during this singular occasion that young Mr. Elliot Whittington Stanley decided to, well, let's say, entertain the 327 wedding guests with a lively, practical joke. You see, young Mr. Whittington Stanley had spent his last few afternoons in the club teen center, teaching his peers a certain Latin incantation he found on the internet. 30 minutes into the wedding ceremony and 15 minutes into Miss Van Beek's vows, Madeline was a lovely girl, but we can all agree she possessed the charisma of a potted plant. Elliot stood abruptly and waved his hand. In response, a cobble of 20 boys rose to their feet and in horrendous unison began to chant, "Mortuae resurgere, mortuae resurgere, mortuae resurgere." As the boys chanted, they stomped their feet in a dreadful rhythm, oblivious to the perplexed and mortified exclamations of their parents and elders. Exclamations gave way to screams as the ground began to quake and fissure, and then, like dandelions from the underworld, skeletal hands burst through the perfectly manicured grass. The skeletal hands were attached to gray, sinewy arms, attached to rotting torsos closed in mildewy leather armor, attached to waxy, worm-eaten heads with empty eye sockets glowing blood red. The reanimated Draugr army had risen from their graves, summoned by the chants of Elliot Whittington Stanley and his delinquent coterie. It pains me to recall the rest of that nightmarish day. Guests screeched and fainted and trampled all over each other, destroying the lawn with their heels. The scent of vomit, urine, and feces soon mingled with the unimaginable fetor of the unearthed Draugr. The Draugr army sprayed Miss Van Beek's dress with curdling intestines. The grunting, mindless creatures shattered the great hall chandelier, reduced the handmade centerpieces to tatters, and tore apart the ballroom like a natural disaster. They tipped the wedding cake into the pond, shattered the mermaid ice sculpture, and scattered Spanish red jumbo prawns across the golf course. For weeks afterward, golfers found rotting prawns stuffed into holes and discarded in sand traps. The Draugr army ate the giraffe and uncaged the lion, which proceeded to chase terrified groomsmen into the harbor. Then, somehow, the Draugr designated the waitstaff an opposing army. The undead horrors proceeded to corral the terrified waiters and bartenders and busboys and corner them in the bridal suite, where the service workers, who weren't even approaching adequate compensation to face a zombie apocalypse, spent a frantic hour until club management could gather the house mages and a counter-incantation return the Draugr army to their subterranean sleep. As expected, the very next day, Mr. Wilbur Van Beek withdrew both his club membership and his promised loan. To this day, the tennis court has not been repaved. Ladies and gentlemen, I should not need to say this. The Draugr army that rests eternally under club grounds is not a toy. It was installed by the founders of the Six Seahorse Sands Club as a line of defense in the event of a lower-class uprising. It's not a prop to be utilized for childish pranks. 2. Jacob Steinberg's Bar Mitzvah. Unfortunately, this event began as something of a mess. The rabbi missed his exit off the expressway and drove halfway to the Hamptons before correcting his mistake, which left guests milling awkwardly about the ballroom for an hour before the ceremony commenced. Young Jacob uncomfortably stuttered his way through his Torah recitation for what felt like another hour. That poor sweet boy was not the brightest candle on the chandelier. And then there were the matter of the golems. A specific minority of invitees, mostly the parents of Jacob's friends not holding memberships to the Six Seahorse Sands Club, were quite perturbed by the presence of the golems in lieu of human waiters. The 7-foot-tall, gray clay men with their featureless bodies, club-like feet, fiery eyes, and gaping mouths did make for a peculiar sight. but Dr. Irving Steinberg had been quite insistent on their presence for two reasons. Firstly, word of the Van Beek wedding fiasco made its way around circles of catering staff in the city, and precious few were eager to accept work at the club and risk a second occurrence. Secondly, the massive clay automatons would serve as a platoon of bodyguards, lest Elliot Whittington Stanley get it into his head to plan another hilarious joke. This time, however, it was Elliot's younger brother, little Roderick Whittington Stanley, whose shenanigans necessitated intervention. Little Roderick's mother, during an awkward hour the assembled patrons waited for the rabbi, had given her younger son a sheet of paper and crayons with which to occupy himself. The boy proceeded to scribble a funny little monster. During the ceremony, he managed to wander away from his mother and somehow climb up the back of a golem. Then the irrepressible scamp reached his chubby little hand into the golem's mouth, removed the shim and replaced it with his crumpled doodle. This immediately rendered the golem, all 7 feet of it, built like a torpedo, Roderick Whittington Stanley's personal man Friday. And what, pray, would a 7-year-old boy ask of an indestructible manservant, beholding only to his whims? The golem accosted Miss Susan Brightboer, custodian of the Six Seahorse Sands Little Crab Children's Club, snatched her wig right off her head, and displayed it as a grotesque trophy atop the south turret. The golem raided the kitchen, plowed its way into the patisserie, and made off with a vat of rosewater ice cream, a Boston cream pie, and 6 dozen chocolate chip cookies, which it proceeded to devour with its young charge. Next, the golem, little Roderick in tow, invaded the esoteric library where the pair terrorized visiting scholars by hiding behind shelves of scrolls, then sprinting out like imps, screaming poop and fart. When the house mages attempted to subdue the creature, it placed Roderick on its shoulders and led its pursuers on a wild steeplechase across club grounds, the little boy screaming, missed me, now you've got to kiss me, all the while. In the end, the house mages could do little to disarm a creature of clay and stone. The Steinbergs and their guests simply had to make do until the sugar high wore off, and both Roderick Whittington Stanley and his commandeered golem curled up asleep under the swing sets. Note to all club members, please mind your children, and be considerate of their maturity before bringing them to any club event. 3. The Six Seahorse Sands Daddy-Daughter Cotillion. The Daddy-Daughter Cotillion is amongst the club's most beloved traditions. Young girls are offered the opportunity to perfect their social graces in a kind, non-judgmental environment, shepherded lovingly by a paternal figure. If club members have no daughters of their own, they're still encouraged to attend the Daddy-Daughter Cotillion in the company of, say, a young female cousin or a favorite niece. Members, however, are not permitted to escort the reanimated corpse of a teenage girl who died of consumption in 1835. They are especially not allowed to bring such a guest if her lower half has been substituted with the legs of a horse and her body has undergone the addition of a scorpion tail. These and all similar beings are explicitly forbidden from the Daddy-Daughter Cotillion, even if, as Dr. Mortimer Whittington Stanley insisted, the ghastly chimera was created in a member's basement laboratory, named Arabella, and claimed as a daughter. Here at the Six Seahorse Sands Club, we take our commitment to non-discrimination very seriously, but I'm sure you'll agree, the stunt was a bridge too far. 4. A reminder of our policy regarding Kelpie rentals. Members are allowed to borrow Kelpies, also known as water horses, from the club's stables on an hourly basis, so long as they remain with the creatures on club grounds. However, the Kelpies must be returned to the stable on the North Harbor and checked back in with staff. The Kelpies may not simply be abandoned in their South Harbor because the renter, say, Elliot Whittington Stanley, lost interest and couldn't rustle up the wherewithal to return the water horse to its appropriate home. We keep the mermaids in the South Harbor. The mermaids are territorial, and they will perceive a Kelpie as an invading species and attack. Kelpies are also kept away from the club swimming pool. Again, please mind your children. They mustn't lead their Kelpies to the pool because, as Roderick Whittington Stanley reasoned, the water horse is cold and should be warmed up in the heated chlorinated water. The Kelpies who keep the pool and spa find the presence of a water horse highly offensive, and when offended, they have a tendency to become feral. 5. The Tennis Courts Incident. File this under Things I Shouldn't Need to Say. Sigils are not to be drawn on the tennis courts. It is highly inappropriate and in a direct violation of club policy to summon a spirit with chalk on the blacktop, and it's doubly inappropriate to summon Abaddon, the destroyer, to terrorize club grounds, particularly if Abaddon, the destroyer, is summoned by a certain 12-year-old boy, for instance, Elliot Whittington Stanley, because his mom says he has to go to his tennis lesson even if he doesn't want to. Which brings us, finally, to the occurrence that served as the proverbial final nail in the coffin of the Whittington Stanley family. 6. Poppy Strauss Bachelorette Party. The very existence of Poppy Strauss's wedding serves as conclusive proof for that old cliché. There is somebody out there for everybody. Miss Strauss was an attractive enough young woman, and she exuded an aura of culture and intelligence. But her temperament could be best compared to a swarm of bees, and her personality swung from pretentious to deliberate ignorance toward anything that contradicted her very high opinion of herself. I won't dare intimate Clifford Van Doren married her solely to obtain a piece of her family's highly profitable chain of seafood restaurants, but I will venture young Mr. Van Doren had always been driven by ambition at the expense of his heart's desire. I was, admittedly, charitable of Miss Cornelia Whittington Stanley to volunteer to act as Miss Strauss's matron of honor. Young Poppy's attitude won her a few friends amongst the club's young female membership, and it was well known that she, familiar with the disaster that became of the Van Beek Wallace wedding, plotted her own nuptials like a general plotting a coup. You see, Miss Strauss spent years embroiled in a largely one-sided social rivalry with Madeline Van Beek. And with Miss Van Beek removed from the Six Seahorse Sands Club membership rolls, her metaphorical throne was left for the taking. Poppy Strauss announced her wedding's theme as A Night in the Agora and went to the ancient Greek angle like a fox at a mink. The long-suffering bridesmaids, unsuspecting cousins, and Shanghai'd sorority sisters would don silken togas. A string quartet of nymphs was procured to entertain guests during cocktail hour. Madeline Van Beek's dress had been flown in from Milan? Well, Poppy Strauss would fly to the altar on the back of a Pegasus. I understand, under the circumstances, Mrs. Cornelia Whittington Stanley must have been saddled with immense pressure to plan a bachelorette party fitting of Poppy Strauss's grand intentions. And it's difficult to lay blame at her feet for simply attempting to calm her friend, to ply her with liquor and unwind her tangled constitution, if only for a night. But all this is no excuse for what happened next. To host Miss Strauss's bachelorette party, thrown in the Lilith wing of the club, Mrs. Whittington Stanley summoned Dionysus himself, along with his legion of bocce. By 8:45, the Lord of Revelry had assembled young women dancing on tables, draining shot after shot of Patron, tearing off their dresses and dashing, shrieking across the golf course in their underclothes. The debauchee, possessed party girls with long claws and sharp teeth, could not be sated until each and every club member, house staff, manager, cook, bartender, and caddy on the premises was fully engaged in the debauchery. There is an unwritten rule here at the Six Seahorse Sands Club. No one is to speak of that night. Those who were present remember little. Flashes of swimming nude in the harbor, arms wrapped around a scaly fishtail, seaweed air brushing one's face, breaking down the doors of the esoteric library, then blue flames, then swaying along, transfixed, as horned creatures scaled the walls with hoofed feet. Racing atop kelpies and pegasi, and on the back of firebirds, chasing leprechauns and imps through the servant hallways. Faint recollections of twirling round and around under a starlit sky, hands clasping tentacles. What club management, not present that night, remember, vividly, is the morning after. Every drop of alcohol on club premises had been sucked dry. The liquor room was reduced to a pile of broken glass. The wine cellar, which once boasted the largest collection of 17th century Italian vintage in the country, had been looted. Bridesmaids and golfers and yachters and assorted club employees, as well as dryads and mermaids and fauns and nephilim, lay about in various states of consciousness and various states of undress. I will spare you the description of the state of the facilities, but, as you all well know, the Six Seahorse Sands Club was shuttered for a month. It took the house, Meiji's, that long to close every portal, banish every djinn to its dimensional plane, and sing every summoned old god back to enchanted sleep. Like I said, enough is enough. The Whittington Stanley family is incompatible with the peaceful, refined culture we strive to maintain at the Six Seahorse Sands Club. By this proclamation, they are blackballed from the premises until further notice. Thank you for your continued compliance. Six Seahorse Sands Club Management. I hope you enjoyed No Longer Welcome at the Six Seahorse Sands Club by Nikki Exposito, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Nikki-Exposito. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/NICKY-EXPOSITO. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Now, before you go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference, and it would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring Twice the Terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the Patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs. Or become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, well, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014, 10 years already. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram too. Just search for Otis Gyre. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.